office in Fauquier.
And
Christopher Morehouse, as I think the court's aware, is here with me today to assist.
All right. And how much time do you need for a rebuttal?
I would ask for 3 minutes, Your Honor.
Certainly. All right. We're happy to hear from you.
Can we start off with a basic thing?
Yes, sir.
What's your client's standing in this case? He doesn't claim any interest in the car. He says none of the items in the car are mine. And the backpack's not mine. What's his standing in this case?
Standing is problematic for my client. Standing is problematic for my client. I have to be candid. The case law, especially in Virginia, states that my client has no expectation of privacy in the vehicle or towards the backpack that he didn't claim.
Uh-huh.
Specifically, the Atkins case comes to mind.
Standing as to the drugs found on his person.
Yes, sir, and certainly a reasonable expectation of privacy on his person himself. What I can say is I don't think that the Atkins case, while I understand that it is good law, I don't think it's correct in light of recent decisions. I think a second look needs to be taken at it. In cases like this where I believe the seizure of the person and the search are so intertwined because the search directly leads to that continued seizure of Mr.
You may, in fact, you probably know this, but a panel of this court is under what we call the interpanel accord doctrine. We can't displace or overrule another panel decision. We have to go en banc or to the Supreme Court. So we often get a pitch that this is wrongly decided, we ought to reconsider it. But at least at this stage of things, our hands are tied.
Yes, sir, and I understand that. I will have to argue, though, while I concede standing is problematic, and that Atkins directly rules against us on this matter in regards to the search of the vehicle itself. I will say that the search of the vehicle, which came through the canine conducting a search around the vehicle, that delay in getting the canine there, that time that it took, the intent of searching the vehicle by the officer who stopped the vehicle, that all resulted in an illegal detention of Mr. Blanton. And he certainly has standing to contest that illegal detention, I think. He was a passenger in the car.
That isn't the question I ask you. The question I ask you, what's his standing for the search? Objected the search.
And to be candid with the court, Your Honor, the best answer I can give again is standing comes through the fact that the search resulted in a longer detention of my client, an elongated detention of my client, waiting for the canine to get there. I really can't give the court a better answer to be candid on that matter.
Well, I think we have to parse this, and we have Rodriguez out there, and of course we've got some recent jurisprudence from this court on that. But under Arizona versus Gant, I think, you know, he's got standing clearly to object to his seizure because he was in the car when it was seized.
Yes, sir.
Whether he's got, Judge Haley correctly, I think, points out, and I think as you more or less concede, that he doesn't have standing because he has no property interest or expectation of privacy in the vehicle or the backpack. However, he does with his person. Now, let me follow up on that and ask about the search of his person, because uniquely in this case, we have this waiver issue where he, as a condition of, or as part of a plea agreement earlier in a different case, he waived any rights he had under the Fourth Amendment. Now, I understand from your brief you're arguing that waiver is limited to basically any rights he had under the federal Constitution, but the waiver doesn't say that. It says, as a condition, hereby waives Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches and seizures of his person and by any law enforcement officer during the period of supervised probation. Now, I understand that the reference is directly to the Fourth Amendment, but we've got a whole bunch of case law in Virginia that says that the Fourth Amendment equivalent of the Virginia Constitution is congruent with that under the federal Constitution. I suspect that's because basically Madison cribbed it all from our Virginia Declaration of Rights that we've had prior to the adoption of the Constitution. So, and I know significantly, I know the Attorney General doesn't raise it on brief in the trial, but, you know, we have to decide these things on the narrowest and best grounds, and we typically don't reach constitutional issues if we don't have to. So if we've got a waiver here that is valid, and then, you know, we don't need to reach a constitutional issue. So can you address that, please?
Yes, sir. I'd ask the court to consider three things regarding the waiver. That waiver was executed, I think, first, the court needs to look at the reasonableness of the waiver. And Anderson was Certainly, the Commonwealth attorney at the motion to suppress asked the trial court to focus on Anderson versus Commonwealth, but the court can examine the reasonableness of the waiver. And if I may, just as a side note, the attorney general argues we did not have the appropriate assignment of error. The brief has the appropriate assignment of error, although the heading is changed, as we weren't sure how to approach a topic that the trial court refused to rule on in and of itself. So I just want to make it clear. I believe our assignment error is exactly as raised in the petition, although the heading for the argument is different. But putting that aside, this was a waiver of 4 years. The probation period was 4 years, if I'm not mistaken. And so this was a much longer time than the 1 year in Anderson. It was a larceny case that Mr. Blanton had been convicted of in Culpeper County, not a drug case, not a weapons case. And while we understand that it was a plea agreement that we concede was freely and voluntarily entered into, the waiving of one's Fourth Amendment rights or any constitutional rights should not be taken lightly, even in a plea agreement.
I mean, I think one of the problems with this waiver area is it's one thing for the Commonwealth, you know, is asking for this as a condition of probation or whatever at the outset. But what you have here is someone who says, yeah, I'll take the deal with all that comes with it. And then at the back end, so, well, you know, this didn't work out for me, so now I want to set it aside. And so that's kind of problematic.
It certainly, again, this was a plea agreement that was signed by our client. There's no indication that it was done in any way but freely and voluntarily. However, again, the reasonableness can still be looked at in terms of, you know, was it reasonable? It's more than likely boilerplate language out of Culpeper County. And while I understand that the waiver itself is very broad, in terms it says, I think, any law enforcement officer he is to submit to, the court, I think, also should look at the fact that this was an investigatory.
It's true, it's broad in that sense, but it's narrow in another sense because it's restricted to his searches of his person, as opposed to his houses, papers, and effects, which is the rest of the Fourth Amendment. So, yep. I mean, you're correct that it's broad in one respect, but it is narrow in another, and it seems to me that may be significant as well.
Yes, sir. It is narrow in that sense, and if this, again, brings up an issue in terms of Mr. Blanton's standing in terms of a search away from his person. If the waiver is looked at narrowly and construed only to Mr. Blanton's person, then the waiver does not extend to the backpack or anything else in the case. Again, the court has already addressed the standing issue with those facts. But that was the third point that I was going to ask the court to consider, is that the waiver, I think, arguably, is narrow in that it only addresses or should only address Mr. Blanton's person, but also the fact that it's a Culpeper County decision. And I would question the fact as to whether one jurisdiction in this county, where probation only would apply in that county, that's the only county that can bring punitive action should there be a violation of probation, can have a defendant stipulate to a waiver in other jurisdictions of his constitutional rights or other rights.
Well, why not? It's an individual right you're waiving.
It is.
It's not a waiver. So, well, I waive my individual right in Culpeper County, is it?
It is an individual right, and the language is somewhat broad in that it says any law enforcement officer. I just question the fact that I think the language should be looked at narrowly construed in favor of the defendant, since it is a restraint on his freedom. And I think that there could have been other language inserted to make it clear that Mr. Blanton was waiving this in any jurisdiction in the Commonwealth.
If it says be of good, at a Culpeper County, be of good behavior, and you get over to Rappahannock County and commit a felony there, could you argue, well, oh, wait a minute, this good behavior only applied to stuff in Culpeper County? In other words, I only got to be a good behavior in Culpeper County.
No, sir. I don't think I could in that case. Obviously, the condition of good behavior extends beyond that area.
Okay.
It's raised in the brief that Mr. Blanton did not waive any of his rights, including under 19.2-59, which I understand deals primarily with search, again, and not seizure. I would respectfully argue to the court that, again, the seizure is a direct result of the fact that the search was done. And certainly Mr. Blanton can contest the search. Going back just to Rodriguez briefly, I think we had a good issue here before Rodriguez was decided, and we had already filed the petition. I think it's even better with Rodriguez. Certainly what you have here is a 30-plus minute traffic stop. A rookie officer pulls the car over. He obtains identifying information from the driver. Everything's good at that time.
Is it your position that the officer, all he can do is just cut the ticket and that's it? Or can the officer at least figure out what's going on, like when the car's weaving or whatever, if there's something else going on that caused the weaving for public safety?
I think if the officer develops additional probable cause, say, upon approaching the driver, he smells a strong odor of alcohol or even a moderate odor, that could elongate the traffic stop because now the purpose of the investigation goes beyond simply issuing perhaps a traffic ticket, but also to investigate.
The car's weaving. So you say, well, why were you weaving, for example, as opposed to just hand me your license, do the warrant check, write the ticket, on your way. Were you drinking, sir? Or, you know, that kind of thing.
I think a question as to were you drinking doesn't necessarily delay elongate the stop to the point where Rodriguez would become concerned. However, a canine sweep of the vehicle is not in the normal course of a traffic stop.
I mean, the problem is I just don't see what Rodriguez has to do with this, because Rodriguez says we're completely done, and now we're going to just make you cool your heels while we get the drug dog out here to run around the car. Here, the questions came at the front end. The delay came at the front end about drugs and, don't be a so-and-so and answer my questions. And then while he's doing the paperwork, that's when the drug dog comes.
Yes, sir.
So really the delay wasn't the drug dog. It was the questioning at the front end. And that's what I'm trying to figure out.
And I think it's a combination of those two factors. Rodriguez says the critical question then is not whether the dog sniff occurs before or after the officer issues a ticket, but whether conducting the sniff prolongs, i.e. adds time to the stop. Now, I agree, it simply wasn't just getting the dog there.
You're starting to do your rebuttal, just so you know.
Yes. I'll finish up quickly then. In terms of Rodriguez, I think Harris and, frankly, Atkins also apply. If you look at the Atkins case, which isn't good for my client on standing, Atkins, in looking at the canine unit, that canine unit was on scene at the time the stop was conducted, and 5 to 7 minutes went by before the stop was concluded. So whether the court wants to consider the detention of the occupants of that vehicle to be illegal because of the questioning outside of the traffic stop, or outside of the what the officer should have asked, and that's a Harris issue, in my opinion, or the fact that the officer waited so long to call the canine and then the time for the canine to arrive. I think both are applicable, and I think that under Harris and Rodriguez, the tension was
far too long. Even if we get to Rodriguez, we have Matthews out there, which, you know, the law at the time of the stop was Rodriguez hadn't been decided at the time of the stop.
Yes, sir.
So, I mean, the officer, we don't expect police officers to be, prescient. They follow the law as it exists at the time, which at that time was Ellis. And Ellis permitted de minimis delays in any event. So even if, if Judge McCullough's observation is mistaken or incorrect, that Rodriguez doesn't apply, I don't see how the exclusionary rule would apply here unless the law at the time under Ellis was violated. Do you want to address that?
I think the exclusionary rule applies if the court's referring to the Davis case that the Attorney General mentions, because the purpose is to deter police misconduct. And I think the court would have to find that there was a good
faith. There's no misconduct if they're following the law that exists at the time. Ellis allowed de minimis delay, and many other states held the same way. And until Rodriguez came along, that was generally considered to be okay.
Yes, de minimis delay, asking a few questions that are unrelated to the traffic stop itself, perhaps maybe if it delayed it a minute or two, is the language that you see in the Commonwealth of Virginia in regards to calling a canine onto the scene. The case law varies widely as to what's a reasonable amount of time, again, prior to Rodriguez. But certainly, if the court looks at Harris or any of the cases that follow from that, the officer here, again, for the first 21 minutes of the stop, did nothing but run the driver's license, get information from the other passengers, which took a matter of minutes, and then went on to ask numerous times of all four passengers, what's in the car? Is there anything illegal in the car? You got to be honest, which was well outside the scope of the stop. It was he had no intent, no probable cause or articulable suspicion that there was anything in the car. And then only 21 minutes into the stop does he think, well, I'm not getting my way, so I'm going to call a canine onto the scene. And that certainly, I think, under any case law, whether you're concerned with the the canine or simply the fact
the historical fact we're stuck with is the trial court saying I don't find that it was an unreasonable amount of time. I don't find any delay in the canine getting there. You know, which under Ellis, I mean, that would have been significant. It seems to me it certainly doesn't matter under Rodriguez.
Well, yes, that was the trial court's ruling, sir. I don't find it so much as a finding. It's not a finding of fact on the trial court's part, but a ruling.
Well, it would be a finding of fact if there's evidence to support it. A mixed question,
yes, sir, perhaps. And I can see that I'm over my time, but again, I don't think, if I can just very briefly address the canine jumping into the car. It never has been our contention.
You can answer his question, but your time has expired.
All right. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have the benefit of your briefs to guide us.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Craig Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Mr. Stallard, let me ask you out of the box. I was curious because I know the Commonwealth attorney relied on it below, but on your brief you didn't argue the waiver issue.
Well, my understanding was the assignment of error that was granted was that the trial court erred in failing to reach the issue, not that the issue was dispositive. And because I don't think the trial court erred in not reaching it is what I put on brief. Obviously, I'm more than willing to discuss the issue if the court feels it's properly before the court. And that being,
well, as I said, we try to decide these things on the narrowest grounds. We try to avoid the constitutional issue if we can. Frankly, I'm surprised the trial court didn't take that opportunity. It was presented to them, and so it basically said, I don't need to rule on the waiver issue because I find the Constitution was satisfied, which is kind of the inverse of the way it should have approached it. But
true.
I was just curious if you had a position on it.
I do think that the waiver is probably valid. I mean, it was negotiated for. It was a basis of the bargain. If he didn't like that, he didn't have to take the plea agreement. He could have tried to negotiate something differently. Commonwealth may or may not have agreed. He could have gone to jail instead of taking the plea agreement. I think it's narrowly tailored to the extent, as the court mentioned, it's limited to searches of his person. It would not include his house, his car, any papers, anything not physically in his possession.
But the issue before us is delay, not the search proper.
Right. And the seizure issue, I think the Fourth Amendment, the waiver also included Fourth Amendment seizure issues. Here, if there is a problem with the stop, it's a seizure at the front end. It's not the delay for the dog. It does take the officer a number of minutes to get from the stop to issuing the citation. I think everything he does in that stop is fully justified given the circumstances he's facing at the time. So I don't think there is a Fourth Amendment problem or violation that occurs from that stop to the time the police dog arrives. And I can go through that with you if you want. But to the extent there is a seizure issue, that would, I think, be covered by the waiver because his person is, in fact, seized and he has waived Fourth Amendment claims to his person. So to the extent there's a waiver that's valid, he's waived that claim prior to the prior plea agreement. Now, it's also important to note that in this traffic stop, this is not a routine traffic stop in the sense that a car is going by speeding, it pulls over on the side of the road, they issue a ticket, the guy goes on. This is where the police officer pulls in behind the car because he hears a loud exhaust, the car begins to weave. It then makes an abrupt turn onto another road, weaves again, and then goes down into a driveway. Now, the officer has run the plates and knows the car is not from this area and has no reason to suspect that this is the person's house or person they're visiting. At that point, the car goes halfway up the driveway. At this point, the police officer then cuts on his lights, pulls in behind the car. So before you even start the police officer interaction with the driver. The driver's taking evasive action to avoid the police officer. So the officer's going to be have some reasonable suspicion based on the conduct and on the way the person's driving. He then gets on the scene. The driver doesn't have a valid license. Nobody in the car has a valid license, at which point the officer has a couple of choices. He can either arrest everybody or arrest the driver for driving unsuspended. And then the other issue he's got to deal with is, am I going to let them take the car away or am I going to tow it? And one of the options he does have is to tow it, and he tells the driver this: look, I can tow the car. There's nobody here who can drive it. I have to impound it. So he's got to determine, is that something I want to do? But to determine that, he's got to talk to the people in the car, find out, is there anything illegal here? Is there anything in the car I need to know about? Is there anything on your person I need to know about? If I'm going to let you all go, I need to make sure that this is a safe environment, that I can do that and nobody's going to get in trouble, or I'm not going to get hurt if I have to search this car, do an inventory search later. Now, ultimately, he decides not to tow the car because he realizes if he impounds it, he's got to keep it for 30 days, apparently. But you can hear that discussion on the tape. At that point, he says, okay, I'm not going to impound it. I'm just going to release him on summons. He gets permission to do that from another officer, at which point he begins to issue the summons, and that's when he requested the drug dog. So all that took time for the officer to talk to these four people, find out what the situation is, what's going on. He knew that she was revoked due to a prior DUI. He saw weaving before the stop. There's a number of factors this officer has to do before he can release the car or release them on a summons. And he was trying to think, given the benefit of the doubt, like, look, is there a reason why I can let you go? But before I do that, I need to know what's going on here. So I think his conduct was reasonable in the way he interacted and the time frame it took from the stop to when the police dog eventually arrived there. Now, as the court said, you need not reach that issue if you find the waiver to be appropriate. And I think the waiver is probably, given the factors that we have and the way it's developed at trial, is valid. I mean, he waived it. It's narrowly tailored. It's applicable to the situation. It deals with the seizure. So in that circumstance, I think it's fine. Well, I also agree with the trial court that there was no Fourth Amendment violation in the traffic stop itself. I think the police officer acted reasonably. Now, I will say,
the trial court, what Judge Haley mentioned, the standing issue. Trial court never addressed standing. But
true. I don't know.
A narrower way to approach.
Right, I don't think anybody ever actually raised it. But yeah, I think standing was obviously an issue there as well. And I will say that reading the facts laid out on paper the first time, I think this looks like a kind of a problem. But when you go back and look at the videotape of the traffic stop, which I'm sure you've done, you will notice that the officer is trying to get this thing resolved as quickly as he can. He's like talking to one person, then he goes to talk to another, and there's another officer talking to the other people. But each officer wants to talk to everybody because, you know, I don't want to trust his opinion, I want to talk to them myself. So, I mean, it does look and feel differently watching the video from the dash cam versus the cold written word of what's going on during the traffic stop. Yes, Your Honor.
What is your position with respect to what I understand to be the appellant's argument that because the seizure was illegal, therefore I have standing for the search of the backpack in the car?
The way I understood him to say it was, because my seizure was extended because of the search of the backpack, I can challenge the search of the backpack. I don't think that is I don't think that's an accurate statement of the law.
Are you aware of any cases that
I am not.
I'm not talking about the person. I'm talking about, I mean, this fellow says, no, it's not my car. It's not my backpack.
Right. He affirmatively disavowed any possessory
interest in any of
the car or any object in the car. It was not his car. He was merely a passenger. And I think the law is fairly clear that you don't have standing to challenge a search of a vehicle of which you have no possessory interest in. And I'm not aware of any exception to that. And I think, assuming arguendo that he does have some standing, the search was perfectly valid also. There's plenty of case law saying a dog jumping in a car.
Standing as to what?
Well, if he wants to challenge the search of the car is valid. If you get to that part down the analysis, the search is valid. The dog alerted to the presence of narcotics by jumping in the car. It's not that he had no probable cause before, until he jumped in. The court found, and there's case law to support the fact, that jumping in the car is indicative of a positive alert of a drug dog, which provides probable cause.
No, but forget the dog and dog going in the car and alerting. If somebody says, that's not my backpack, before the dog gets there.
Yeah, there's no standing. Absolutely.
I'm old enough to remember when Jones versus United States was the law, where you had automatic standing if there was a Fourth Amendment issue. Supreme Court overruled that a long time ago, and my understanding is if you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the place searched or the thing seized, or I guess since Jones now a couple of years ago, some property interest in the property seized or searched, you don't have standing.
And that's my understanding of the law as well, Your Honor. My only point was, even if he does have standing, the search is fine. But I don't think he has standing, so I don't even think we need to get to the issue of whether or not the search is appropriate, although I think it was. I think it was the point I was trying to make, Your Honor. But, yeah, I agree with the court that I'm not aware of any exception to the standing issue in this case. And if the court has no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm the trial court. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, we'll come down and greet counsel, and we'll take a short recess.